With the point in discussing covenanting, the ordinance of covenanting, we're going to talk about the renovation of covenants or renewal of covenants. Again, the fourth term of communion, that public social covenanting is an ordinance of God, obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament, that the national covenant and the solemn league are an exemplification of this divine institution, and that these deeds are of continued obligation upon the moral person. And in consistency with this, that the renovation of these covenants at Arkansas, 1712, was agreeable to the word of God. So I'm going to read a section of the preface to the renewal of covenants, and then we're going to go over some of the questions, some of the topics that they bring up. This is what they did, and we want to look at renewing covenant in light of that, because they're enunciating several principles that are important when it comes to what we're saying is important to be observed in any kind of covenant renewal. This is an exemplification, and as I say, we're going to begin in the preface. It is the ineffable product of eternal love and infinite condescension in God toward his rational creatures that ever he was pleased to make a covenant with them, and not to command and require obedience to his holy and just will by virtue of his most absolute supremacy and rightful dominion only, but even to superadd sweet and precious promises as a reward of that obedience which he might of right have required without giving any such incitements or persuasives to it. And as no tongue of man or angels is sufficient to express, no strength of imagination to conceive, no sublimity of intellectual faculties to comprehend the depth of that spring and breadth of that ocean of unbounded love which has exerted itself in God's covenanting with man, yea, with sinful man, by means of a mediator, so shall it also afford matter of wonder and admiration to all finite and intelligent beings, to the ages of eternity, and shall never be comprehended by any but him whose understanding is infinite. Wherefore he, who is all-sufficient and self-sufficient, should invite, yea, press and entreat unworthy, indigent nothings, the sinful children of men, to such an incomparable degree of honor, dignity, and advancement, as this is, to enter into a covenant relation and come into a solemn treaty of peace and conjunction with him, who is infinitely removed beyond all blessing and all praise, to have this invitation is indeed the honor and privilege of all within the visible church, to whose ears a joyful sound of the gospel, glorious gospel of Jesus Christ hath come. But few are so wise as to accept and improve it. Many, too, many account themselves unworthy of this honor, and by despising this privilege and rejecting this dignity, deprive themselves of the greatest happiness. But as all nations upon whom the day star of the gospel hath arisen have had the invitation to this duty, and all sound and real believers have actually participated of this honor, to have God making a covenant with them, and they striking hands with him through a mediator, which covenant is commonly termed the covenant of grace. So these three kingdoms of Scotland, England, and Ireland, conjunctly, and Scotland itself, by itself, as an independent nation, had in an eminent way and manner the honor above most nations in the world to dedicate and surrender themselves to the Lord by a most voluntary, free, and deliberate choice, and to come under the bond of a most solemn oath, in a most religious manner, devoting their all to Christ, his interest and honor, the flourishing and thriving of his kingdom, the success of his gospel and reformation of his church, and openly avouching him for their Lord and Master to the honor of his name and confusion of his enemies. Which covenants, national and solemn league, though we look not upon them to be the same with the covenant of grace, yet we conceive of them as a solemn superadded and new obligation, tying us to all the duties as well of a particular Christian conversation as these which tend to the public and national advancement of Reformation in religion, whereof the covenant of grace is the spring and foundation. These covenants, as they were the effects and consequence of many remarkable and signal expressions of divine love and goodness, many singular mercies and deliverances vouchsafed to these nations, as the return of many earnest prayers and wrestlings of the Lord's people with him, so they were the occasions of many blessings and great indications of God's favor and loving kindness. Then the Lord delighted to dwell in the nations. Then did he beautify the place of his sanctuary. Then did he fill his people's hearts with joy and gladness by the familiar intimations of his special love and downpourings of his Spirit's gracious influences, as our Lord can afford many instances. Then did he enlarge his people's affections and animate their spirits with zeal and courage, attended with knowledge, prudence, and discretion to act for him and advance his kingdom. Then did he illustrate his churches in these kingdoms as bright and sparkling stars arising out of the thick clouds of anti-Christian darkness and getting out from under prelatic and Erastian yokes of bondage and slavery, and made them go forth of the meridian sun, glorious and excellent, terrible as an army with banners. Hence it came to pass that these nations sent out a savory report to all the neighboring Reformed churches, a report which comforted, revived, strengthened, animated, and encouraged all the true and loyal subjects of Christ's kingdom, which struck terror and amazement to the hearts of his enemies, which shook and caused to tremble the pillars of Antichrist's kingdom, and disquieted the very foundations of the seat of that beast, which made malignants at home and abroad to be ashamed and confounded, and even forced the haters of the Lord to feign submission to him. Numberless were the advantages and privileges which did redound to these nations by, and were the lovely attendance and sweet consequence of these covenants, whereby God did set to his seal of approbation and gave clear evidence and demonstration of his acceptance of his people, cheerful and willing adventurers in this duty of covenanting with him. And as these blessings and mercies, which as the dew of Hermon were distilled upon the people's heads and hearts, while they abode steadfast with him and faithful in his covenant, were so many irrefragable proofs of his acquiescence in their just and laudable undertakings, so the many sad and fearful plagues, distractions, confusions, and miseries which have attended and followed the many gross breaches and violations of these covenants and departures from God are no less evident discoveries, undeniable signs, and pregnant convictions of the Lord's most just displeasure and indignation with the bypassed and present courses of revolting and backsliding from him, which courses of declension and grievous apostatizing from God and his covenant, all the three kingdoms, and in special this nation and every individual therein, capable of such a work, is without all controversy called to bewail and confess before God, and by speedy amendment to turn from them in order to avert judgments and turn away justly impendent wrath and long-threatened strokes. The consideration of these blessings and benefits, on the one hand, which followed the zealous entering into and sincere performing of these sacred oaths, and upon the other hand, the sense we desire to retain of the plagues and curses threatened by God in his word against covenant breaking, inflicted upon covenant breakers in former ages and foreign nations, and visibly impending upon us in these nations for our perfidious dealing in God's covenant, hath moved us, a poor, insignificant handful of people, unworthy indeed to be called the posterity of our zealous reforming ancestors, though heartily desirous to be found adherers to the same standard of doctrine, worship, discipline, and government to which they adhered, to attempt this solemn and weighty duty of renewing, in our capacities and stations, these covenant obligations, that we might at least give some discovery of our respect to the cause of God. For the advancement and preservation whereof these covenants were first entered into, and afterwards again and again renewed by our religious progenitors, and by the whole representative body of the three kingdoms, who had any zeal for the interest of religion, and that we might for our parts be in some measure instrumental to transmit a testimony for the work of God in our land to the succeeding generation. Neither do we want, beside these general motives, some special inducements to this undertaking, as first, because these national covenants, having been nationally broken, and their funeral piles erected by wicked and perfidious rulers in the capital cities of the kingdom, with all imaginable ignominy and contempt, have long lain buried and almost quite forgotten under these ashes, most people either hating the very name and remembrance of them, or at least being ashamed honorably to avouch their adherence to them, and afraid to endeavor a vigorous and constant prosecution of the duties contained in them. So that it's high time that everyone should do his utmost towards a reviving of them. Number two, because many openly declare their sorrow and grief that ever these covenants should have been entered into. Malignants calling them a conspiracy, attributing every miscarriage of the persons engaged in them to the covenants themselves as their native effects. And others who would take it ill to be called malignants, making them the causes of all the tyranny, rapine, bloodshed, and persecution of the late reigns, as having raised the spleen of the enemies of religion, and accounting it safer that they should lie still in their graves than that they should irritate malignants any more by their resurrection. Therefore, we judge it our duty to renew them, that we might evidence that notwithstanding all these malicious calumnies and false consequences cast upon them, we are still of the same judgment with our reformers, that they are the most sovereign means under the blessing of God for reviving and preserving the work of God in the land. Number three, because of the courses that are carried on in direct opposition to these covenants, the nations formerly cemented in peace and love in conjunction with truth and righteousness, having broken these bonds and united themselves upon another footing by the late sinful incorporating union, and imposing new oaths in opposition to the covenant, such as the abjuration, etc., granting license, protection, and toleration to all the evils abjured in the covenant, as heresies and errors in doctrine, superstition in worship, prelacy and Erastianism in government, and overthrowing all good discipline. Number four, because of our own sinful miscarriages in and woeful declinings from our covenanted duties, our proneness to break covenant with God and to be indifferent, lax, negligent, and unsteadfast in the covenant, in the cause and work of God, and to be led away with the error of the wicked, and to fall from our steadfastness, wherefore we thought it necessary to bind ourselves by a new tie to the Lord and one to another in a zealous prosecution of covenanted duties, that the covenant might be as a hedge to keep us from running out into the paths of destroyers. Number five, we being sincerely desirous and having an earnest longing to celebrate the sacred ordinance of the Lord's Supper, whereof many had unjustly called us despisers and condemners, and finding it to have been the laudable practice of the Church of Scotland formerly, that all such as were admitted to that holy table should swear and subscribe the covenant before their coming thereunto, we judged it a fit preparative for receiving a sacramental confirmation of God's covenanted love and favor to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, that we should avouch him for our God and testify our adherence to his cause and truth by our renewing of our national covenants with him. Upon these and like weighty considerations, we resolve to set about this solemn and tremendous duty, and being assured that we have no sufficiency in ourselves for any such undertaking, after frequent imploring the Lord for light and direction, strength and assistance, and seeking for ourselves a right way in the performance of the duty upon days of humiliation, both in our private societies and publicly in the fields, we did condescend upon the following acknowledgement of sins, the more to enable us to remember our own and the land's breaches of covenant in our solemn public confession thereof, and to draw up the following engagements to duties, not to superadd any new article or obligation to the covenants, but only to adjust the articles of the covenant to the circumstances of the time, and to explain in what sense the covenant binds us against the present evils that are now prevalent in the land, and to contrary duties. As for the covenants themselves, we made no material alteration in them, as judging it a work more proper for an assembly of divines or representative body of the church and state, had they been upright and faithful in this cause, than for us, who, as we are called by others in contempt, must own ourselves in truth to be but a handful of weak and mostly illiterate people, and but as babes in comparison to the first framers of our covenants, only that we might make them in some measure accommodable to the present lamentable circumstances, whereinto we are involved by our iniquities. We have annotated some few necessary alterations upon the margins, wherein the judicious will find that we have in nothing receded from the scope and substance of the covenants, but only in the phrase. For instance, where the covenant binds to the defense and preservation of the king's majesty and government, in regard we have no king, nor supreme civil magistrate, so qualified as God's law and the laudable laws of this realm require, to whom we might for conscience sake subject ourselves in a consistency with our defending the true reformed religion in all its parts and privileges. Therefore, we can only bind ourselves to defend and preserve the honor, authority, and majesty of lawful sovereigns or supreme magistrates having the qualifications aforesaid when God shall be pleased to grant them to us. Where no judicious person will say that there is any substantial alteration as to the matter of the duty, but only as to the object to whom the duty is to be performed, there being none such in being as can justly claim, or to whom we may with good conscience pay such an allegiance. Having mutually agreed concerning these prerequisites to this sacred action, that the same might be orderly gone about and might not be performed in a clandestine way, so as to preclude any upright-hearted friends to the covenanted Reformation from joining with us in that so necessary a duty, there was public intimation made of the design a competent space of time before upon a day of humiliation, and likewise upon the Lord's Day immediately preceding the work. As for the particular way in manner, method, and circumstances of the work, we had not given any narrative of them, but that some who come with an evil eye to spy on our liberty for criticizing, not for joining or profiting, have in part misrepresented the same and may further do so. Therefore, to obviate all such misreports, we thought it fit to make this brief relation thereof. Upon Wednesday, July 23rd, these that had the work and design being met together, the minister began the day's work with prayer for special assistance to attain due preparation for and a suitable frame throughout the whole of the solemnity. And thereafter had a prefatory discourse to the people, showing the nature of the work in general, its lawfulness, expediency, and necessity, scripture precedents, and proven examples of the people of God, adducing the ninth chapter of Ezra, Nehemiah, Ezekiel, Dan, and Nehemiah 10, 28 and 29, for proof thereof. And of the day in particular, that it was a day of fasting and supplication with preaching of the word in order to preparation for the solemnities intended, both of renewing the covenants and celebrating the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, after which a part of the 78th Psalm from the 5th verse to the 12th being sung, Mr. John McNeil, preacher of the gospel, had a sermon upon Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5. In those days and in that time, saith the Lord, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together, going and weeping. They shall go and seek the Lord their God. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come and let us join ourselves unto the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten. from which text he raised and prosecuted largely and particularly these two following observations as most pertinent for the work of the day. The first implicitly supposed, the other more explicitly asserted in the words. That is, first, that a people in covenant with God may be forgetful of and deal falsely in their covenant, or that covenant takers may be covenant breakers. Second, that it is the duty of a people who've broken covenant with God to engage themselves again to the Lord by the renovation of their covenants. When prosecuting the former, he showed by that what gradual steps of declension a people usually come to deal falsely in God's covenant, such as, number one, by forgetfulness, Deuteronomy 4:23. There being a connection between forgetting and forsaking, or dealing falsely in God's covenant. So the church intimates in Psalm 44:17-18, all this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten thee, neither have we dealt falsely in thy covenant. Our heart is not turned back, neither have our steps declined from thy way. And the returning remnant of Israel, being sensible of this connection, resolved to bind themselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that may never be forgotten. Number two, by seeking shifts and arguments to elude and evade the obligation of the covenant and to defend the breaches thereof, which is, after vows, to make inquiry. Number three, by despising the bond of it, Ezekiel 16:59, which has despised the oath in breaking the covenant. Number four, by defection to the iniquities which are sworn engaged against in the covenant, Jeremiah 11:10. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenants, which I made with their fathers. Number five, by changing the government laws and ordinances sworn to be maintained in the covenant, either the government of the state without consulting divine direction and due inspection into the qualification of the person set up, Hosea 8 compared for first and fourth verses, they've transgressed my covenant, they set up kings but not by me, princes and I knew it not, that is, without consulting me to know my will and without my approbation and consent, or the government of the church without regard to the revealed will of God. Thus Abijah justly charges Jeroboam that he had cast out the priests of the Lord, the sons of Aaron and the Levites, and that he made priests after the manner of the nations of the other lands, but encourages himself that he and Judah had the Lord for their God because they had not forsaken him, and the priests which ministered unto the Lord were the sons of Aaron, 2 Chronicles 13:9-10. Number six, by an entire forsaking and disowning the obligation of the covenant, Daniel 11:30, He shall have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. Number eight, by a stated opposition to the covenant and persecuting of these who adhere thereunto. Thus Elijah justly charges Israel, 1 Kings 19:10, that they had forsaken God's covenant because they had thrown down the altar, slain his prophets, and sought after Elijah's life. And in a use of lamentation deduced from the foresaid doctrine, he showed that all ranks in the land had reason to mourn over the breach of covenant. In regard, some of all ranks from the throne to the dunghill in church and state are or have been guilty of dealing falsely in God's covenant in all and every one of these diverse ways or end of declining from them. And in regard that there has been so much ignominy and contempt cast upon these sacred covenants, not only by breaking them openly, but also avowedly disowning and disdaining their obligation and making their adherence to them criminal, which is above all burning them by the hand of the hangman and burying them so long in forgetfulness. This guiltiness he applied not to great persons only, but also to professors, to ministers, and particularly to ourselves, who are called dissenters from the present establishment, pressing upon us no less than others the absolute and indispensable necessity of being convinced of and mourning over these, not as the sins of others only, but also as our own. We having a chief hand in the trespass, pressing upon all present concerned in the work of the duty of self-examination and putting themselves to the trial concerning their knowledge of the covenant obligations, both as to their nature and extent, as well as their sense of the breaches of these obligations. The second head of doctrine, that it's the duty of a people who've broken covenant with God to engage themselves again to Him by renovation of their covenants. After proving the proposition by several heads of arguments deduced, number one, from the lawfulness of entering into covenant with God, whether personal, as Jacob, Genesis 28, 20 and 21, or economical, as Joshua and his family, Joshua 24, 15, or national, as God brought his people Israel under a covenant with himself, Exodus 19, 5. The consequence is holding undeniably that if it be lawful and necessary in any of these respects to enter into covenant with God, it must needs be also lawful and a duty to renew the same after the breach thereof. Number two, from scripture precepts of the people of God, who after breaking in of and declining from God's covenant, renewed the same, as for instance, the covenants made with Israel at Horeb was renewed at the plains of Moab, Deuteronomy 29, by Joshua chapter 24, by Asa, 2 Chronicles 15, 13 and 14, by Jehoiada, 2 Kings 11, 17, by Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 29, 10, by Josiah, 2 Kings 23, 2, by Ezra and Nehemiah, Ezra 10, 3, Nehemiah 9, last verse, and 10, 28 and 29. Thirdly, from scripture precepts, Deuteronomy 29. Verse 1, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Psalm 76:11, vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Number 4, from scripture promises wherein the Lord promises as a blessing and mercy to his church and people that they should renew their covenant with him. Isaiah 19, verses 18, 21, 23, 24, 25, and Zechariah 2:11. Now, for further opening of the proposition, these two questions were proposed and solved. Number one, whether all persons who've broken covenant with God may be admitted to renew the same. Answer, all sorts of persons in the three kingdoms are under the obligation of the covenant, consequently bound to renew and keep it inviolable. But all are not in present capacity, therefore have no actual right to enter into covenant. Such as are obstinately wicked, living in error, profanity, and malignancy, have not God's call and right from him as such to renew a covenant with him. For Psalm 50, verses 16 and 17, God says to the wicked, what hast thou to do to take my covenant in thy mouth? But all such as are reformed or reforming from all iniquity, namely from defections and compliances of the time, who have some suitable sense of the breaches, and competent knowledge and understanding of the duties engaged unto in the covenant, according to Nehemiah 10:28, have a right and an immediate call to the duty of renewing covenant. Secondly, if any number of people may renew a national oath and covenant without the consent and concurrence of royal authority, or at least without the concurrence of some chief and principal men in church and state, I answer, without the concurrence of church and state, a covenant cannot be taken or renewed nationally speaking, strictly. Yet a few may publicly declare their adherence to their covenant engagements by renewing them, not only without the consent and concurrence of authority, but against it. There are several precedents for so doing, both before and since the established Reformation. For instance, that covenant at Edinburgh, 1557, at Perth, 1559, at Stirling, same year. Another at Leith, 1560, another at Ayr, 1562, and at Lanark, a small handful of the Lord's people renewed it in direct opposition to, and at Leshmahago, without the consent or concurrence of authority, which instances may be both an inducement and an encouragement to us to renew, and in our mean capacity to testify to the nation, our approbation of and adherence to these covenants. Now, the prosecution of this doctrine, he had occasion also to insist upon the reasons or motives and manner of entering into covenant. The scope and argument of the reasons adduced as motives to the duty of covenanting was to this effect. Number one, the turning away the Lord's wrath and anger from a land or people which covenant breaking has deserved may be a motive to renew covenant with God. This was a motive that prompted the good king, reforming King Hezekiah to make a covenant with the Lord in 2 Chronicles 29:10. Now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. Nehemiah, with returned captives in Nehemiah 9, last verse, and because of all this, we make a sure covenant. Number two, for reviving and advancement and reformation being the ordinary consequence and effect of upright covenanting with the Lord, may be another motive and inducement thereunto. This appears both in personal and national covenanting. In personal, if we look at Psalm 119:106, I've sworn and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments. His having sworn was a very quickening consideration to excite him to the performance of his duty. In national covenanting, we always find after the people of Israel and Judah had covenanted with the Lord, they made progress in reformation, and the land was purged of the abominations and the idols. And thus it was in Asa's covenant in 2 Chronicles 15:12 to the 19th verse. For there, the people, having entered into a covenant with the Lord and sworn with all their soul and with all their heart, the Lord was found of them. And Asa removed his mother Maacah from her royal dignity and stamped the idol which he'd made and burnt it at the brook Kidron and brought into the house of the Lord the thing that his father and himself had dedicated. Thus it was also in Jehoiada's covenant that he made between the Lord, the king, and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, 2 Kings 11:17-18, and 20. For immediately after the making of this covenant, all the people of the land went into the house of Baal and break it down, his altars, his images, break the in pieces thoroughly. And the priests appointed officers over the house of the Lord, and they slew Athaliah with the sword. The like is evident in Hezekiah's covenanting, 2 Chronicles 29:30-31. And in Josiah's in 2 Chronicles, the 34th and 35th chapters. Number three, this upright renewing of covenant with the Lord is a way and a means to procure many mercies, both spiritual and temporal, from the hand of the Lord, which would be a strong inducement and motive to engagement thereunto. Spiritual mercies are entailed upon it. Deuteronomy 29:12-13. That thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God, and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people to himself, that he may be unto thee a God, as he has said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Temporal mercies are also promised to this upright renewing and keeping covenant, Deuteronomy 29:9. Keep therefore the words of this covenant, and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. It is remarked in 2 Chronicles 15:5 that after Asa's covenant, the Lord gave them rest round about. Number four, the malice and opposition of the popish, prelatical, and malignant party against the covenant, and their doing what in them lies to make their obligation void and null, may be a motive and argument for the people of God, so much the more to avouch their respect to them by a public adherence, especially after long-continued breaches. Number five, upright entering into a renewing covenant with God is a most sovereign medicine for healing of people's breaches as well as their backslidings, the covenant being the cement as well as to join and unite the people of God one to another as all of them in their duty to God. As it flows from the nature of the covenant to unite the friends of reformation, so it is observable as the Lord has followed thereupon, but so it is observable as one of the peculiar fruits of the covenant renewing, that union in the Lord has followed thereupon. Thus it was with Israel and Judah in the text, united together in making covenant with the Lord, whence all the people of God who were called to be united and perfectly joined together in the same spirit and the same mind, and especially they who have been lamentably divided one from another, by their manifold defections from God and from their covenant engagements, ought to be strongly inclined, moved, and engaged to this duty from this consideration, that upright covenant renewing is a useful means of land uniting and church uniting dispositions amongst the people of God. Stop there. So, the beginning of the document itself, they're going to give us point by point a number of things that they've done. We're going to go over the first section of it now and break it down a little bit, what they're talking about, so it's a little bit easier to understand. First question then is this: is covenanting with God, especially national covenanting, a necessary and expedient duty approved in the scriptures? And the answer is yes. We want to look at Deuteronomy 29, 1.
Deuteronomy 29, verse 1. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb.
In the Old Testament, it is here evident the Lord commanded to enter into this covenant and oath. Again, Deuteronomy 29, 1 and then verse 12.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 1 and 12, verse 1. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. And verse 12, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day.
Okay, and we know not only is it in the Old Testament, it's never abrogated in the New Testament except in ordinary communications. Look at Matthew 5:37 and James 5:12.
Matthew 5, verse 37. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil.
James 5:12. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by earth, by the earth, neither by any other oath. But let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation.
And this was also condemned in the Old Testament as well as the New. Look at Exodus 20, verse 7.
Exodus 20, verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless to take his name in vain.
So what we know is this. We know the Old Testament teaches covenanting. We know that the New Testament, when it's talking about oaths and vows, contrary to Anabaptists, it's not condemning all oaths and vows. It's just simply saying that it should not be part of our everyday discourse. We shouldn't be continually entering into oath taking, and that's not, in fact, a New Testament only ethical standard. That is based squarely upon the commandment in the Ten Commandments. All right, it's so far from being abrogated that it's confirmed by the apostle in Galatians 3:15.
Galatians 3, verse 15. Brethren, I speak it after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant, yet if I be confirmed, no man disannulleth or addeth thereto.
And concerning even promissory oaths, he confirms them. Hebrews 6:16.
Hebrews 6:16. Men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife.
So the scriptural precedent for national covenanting is clearly taught in the Old Testament, never abrogated in the New. And there are, in fact, promises relating to the New Testament times, not only of personal, but of national covenanting, as churches and Christian societies or nations. Look at Isaiah 19:18-21, 23-25, Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5, and Zechariah 2:11.
Isaiah 19, verse 18. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to the God or to the Lord of hosts. One shall be called the city of destruction. Verse 21. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt and to the Egyptians. And the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and perform it. Verses 23 through 25. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. And the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance.
Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5. In those days and in that time, saith the Lord, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together, going and weeping, they shall go and seek the Lord their God. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, Come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten.
Zechariah 2, verse 11, And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto thee.
Okay, so we have a teaching in the Old Testament, not abrogated in the New. In fact, we have Old Testament prophecies talking about this doctrine of covenanting, which we've been talking about for a number of weeks now, and we've looked at from a number of different angles. So the idea of covenant renovation is against this backdrop. We have to affirm, first of all, that covenanting is something that is enjoined on the church under the New Testament era. If it's not a duty, a present duty, it wouldn't concern us, but it is. And that's why the authors and the people who are were really partakers and participants in this renewal of covenant, they were concerned to make this clear. We're not doing something without precedent. Okay, we have a duty to covenant. If you remember, at the very beginning, in fact, they talk about the condescension of God in covenanting with us and allowing us to covenant with Him. You know, God could simply tell us, do it, and that would be enough. He doesn't have to promise us anything. You know, there doesn't need to be a carrot. It could be all stick, and God would be right, and His prerogative would be sound. He would have every right to do that. But He does more. He allows us to enter into covenant with Him. He deals with us in a way that is, in fact, covenantal, so that we are put in a position to act in a voluntary and free way in our respect to Him. You know, He could just simply say, do it, and we would have to do it. There could be He could put His proverbial foot down and just make a demand. But He's chosen to deal with His people by way of covenant so that we might enter into a voluntary relation in a way of obedience. And this covenanting that we're talking about is really, in a sense, based upon this. It's the same idea. We are reacting to the covenant of grace. We're taking hold of it. So that's what this social covenanting is. Now, the second question, are there also scriptural precedents for renewal of these covenants? Well, again, yes. Look at Deuteronomy 29:1 one more time.
Deuteronomy 29:1. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which He made with them in Horeb.
Yeah, this covenant is being renewed in Moab, the one He made in Horeb. And it's not the only time. Throughout the Bible, Israel is going to renew covenant again and again and again. In fact, most of the covenant transactions that we're going to see are covenant renewals. These covenants were renewed again and again for the preservation and reformation of religion, for the extirpation of false worship, maintaining their laws, liberties, and government, punishing and restraining the wicked, keeping the common peace and mutual defense against common enemies. Thus were they renewed by Joshua. Look at Joshua 24:25.
Joshua 24:25. Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem.
And by Asa, 2 Chronicles 15:13-14.
2 Chronicles 15:13-14. That whosoever would not seek the Lord God of Israel should be put to death, whether small or great, whether man or woman. And they swear unto the Lord with a loud voice, and with shouting, and with trumpets, and with cornets.
And by Jehoiada, 2 Kings 11:17.
2 Kings 11:17. And Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people. The Lord's people, between the king also and the people.
Okay, the point of all of this is, when it says he made a covenant, what they're really doing is a renewing covenant. They've already taken this covenant. The covenant's been broken. They're coming forward to renew that covenant, to re-enter in. They're concerned that this covenant be maintained in purity, that the intention of it be honored. Now, the real question that they raise, and one of the interesting things that comes up, has to do with the question of whether or not they had a right to do this. After all, they say, look, we're not the nation, nor are we the church in a national capacity. We're just a bunch of dissenters from the establishment. We're just a handful of weak and illiterate people. What can we do? Can we do this? And their answer is yes. And so, again, may the covenant be tendered without the magistrate? Yes. Look again at 2 Kings 11:17.
2 Kings 11:17. And Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, that they should be the Lord's people between the king also and the people.
Yeah, justice and order requires that whoever has the greatest influence upon or authority over the community should tender the oath. That's the point of what happened in Jehoiada's day, or in Asa's day, or Joshua's day. It belongs to magistrates to enjoin it, but not so as to exclude themselves from coming under the bond of it. And in that case, they must have some tender it to them. Now, in Scripture, we find the officers of the church imposing it, as Jehoiada, both to King Joash and to the people. 2 Chronicles 23:16.
2 Chronicles 23:16. And Jehoiada made a covenant between him and between all the people, and between the king, that they should be the Lord's people.
And we see it in Ezra's day. Ezra made the priests and the Levites and all Israel to swear it. Look at Ezra 10:4-5.
Ezra 10, arise, for this matter belongeth unto thee. We also will be with thee. Be of good courage and do it. Then arose Ezra and made the chief priests, the Levites, and all Israel swear that they should do according to this word. And they swear.
Yeah, and they swear. What were they doing? They were renewing covenant. Why? Well, Ezra's tendering it. He's doing it even without the consent of the magistrate, who is a heathen king of Persia. So, their renewal of covenant, while it would be desirable, it would be, in fact, the most desirable thing for the chief magistrate to be involved. It would be most desirable in the church for the representatives of the church to be involved. And yet, if they're not going to do their duty, that does not mean that we are not allowed, or that we should in some way avoid doing our duty. We still have a duty. We still have an obligation. The obligation is not lessened. Our situation is exasperated by the fact that they're not going to participate, but that doesn't lessen our duty. It doesn't lessen the fact that we have an obligation. We bear an obligation. All of the people in a church or a nation have an obligation to uphold the laws, the rules, the ordinances of that church or that nation. And just because most of the nation is going astray, most of the nation is no longer following those rules, most of the nation has become corrupted, doesn't mean that we should allow that to happen to ourselves. One of the things that Arkansas is teaching us is that even in this matter, Caesarius is covenanting, it's never safe to follow a multitude to do evil. It's better to be part of a weak and illiterate minority seeking to be found faithful than part of a majority that is, in essence, going to hell. I mean, they're right on the edge. You know, and these guys are not saying that everybody who's not engaged with them is going to hell. But what they are saying is that there are a lot of people who should be engaged, and they're not. And they're not going to, because they're heavily compromised. You know, they have one foot in each camp. You know, they want to straddle the fence. There are a lot of people that want to be half in and half out. And we never know which way that's going to fall. We don't know, and we may not know for a lot of people until Judgment Day. That's all the more reason they're saying we need to do what's right. We need to pull in this direction. We need to follow through. There's been a breach. And it's not a little thing. I mean, everybody knows it. There's been a breach. There's been moral turpitude. There's been doctrinal laxity. And one of the things they pointed out was that before you could even come to the Lord's Supper, you had to subscribe to covenants. How could things have gotten that far without a conspiracy of the majority to, at the very least, ignore their responsibility to these things? All right, question four. In what form ought covenants to be renewed? Unalterably or with alterations? Well, let's look again at Deuteronomy 29:1.
Deuteronomy 29, verse 1. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb.
Okay, it's plain here, some way another covenant than that sworn in Horeb. Okay, you have something other. It's not exactly. Look at Deuteronomy 4, 10 to 14 and 23. And Deuteronomy 5, 2, and 3.
Deuteronomy 4, verses 10 to 14. Especially the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. And ye came near, and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only ye heard a voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. And he wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that ye might do them in the land whither ye go over to possess it. And verse 23. Take heed unto yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee.
Deuteronomy 5, verses 2 and 3. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day.
Moses is very clear. It's the same covenant. It's clear then that it has to be a renovation of that former covenant rather than a substitution. Same covenant going on, but there are alterations. It's translation of the form, but not the matter. Accommodation to the circumstances, sins, and duties of that time when they were in the land of Moab. Again, look at Deuteronomy 29:1.
Deuteronomy 29:1. These are the words of the commandment which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb.
We know it's somewhat altered from the case that they were in at Horeb. Deuteronomy 5:2 again.
Deuteronomy 5:2. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb.
Yeah, so we have what is substantially the same covenant. But the form has been changed. Not the matter, but the form of it. It's been changed. There's been alteration. And it's been altered mainly to take into account the present circumstance. You know, things change circumstantially. But principally, things don't change. And there are great moral principles which don't change. And that's a big part of the point of what is going on with the Arkansas renovation. They're saying, look, just because our circumstances change, it doesn't mean that we're not bound to these same principles. We may be circumstantiated in such a way that we can't keep the covenant in the exact form. But principally, there are proper applications, and we'll eventually get to some of them, right? I mean, he mentioned some along the way, the idea of changing the king's majesty to lawful sovereign magistrate when we have one. All right. The fact is, the covenant at Horeb was more full and particular, suiting all times. We get Exodus 19, 5 to 8, and 24, 3, and 7.
Exodus 19, 5 to 8. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord hath spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord.
Exodus 24, verses 3 and 7, verse 3. And Moses came and told the people the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord hath said will we do. Verse 7. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, all that the Lord had said will we do and be obedient.
So that's what we have at Horeb. It's very full, very plain, very particular in certain ways, but it's also setting down a series of principles. It's enunciating principles. And like any good setting forth a principle is only made more helpful, more efficacious when there's some sort of a context given. So we have a context. We can see a little bit how it is envisioning these things going into effect, how this is going to be carried out. With renewal contains the same, but more generally proposed, with a particular acknowledgement of the sins against and breaches of that covenant. Deuteronomy 29, 2 to 9.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 2 through 9. And Moses called unto all Israel and said unto them, ye have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt and Pharaoh, and all his servants, and unto all his land, the great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs, and those great miracles. Yet the Lord hath not given you a heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxing old upon you, and thy shoe is not waxing old upon thy foot. Ye have not eaten bread, neither have ye drunk wine or strong drink, that ye might know that I am the Lord your God. And when ye came unto this place, Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us unto battle, and we smote them. And we took their land and gave it for an inheritance unto the Reubenites, and to the Gadites, and to the half tribe of Manasseh. Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do.
So, what we have is a covenant renewal that is, in fact, accommodated to the times, right? Now, unlike when the first covenant was taken, they've passed through this period of time. They've had certain experiences. They're familiar with the workings of the Lord in some different ways. They've had run-ins with God in the wilderness. They're renewing covenant, and they're in a better position to say, look, we went wrong here. We went wrong there. Shouldn't have done that. That didn't work out. And then to move on to new engagement to duties thereof and more express explication and application of the universality and extent of its obligation. Look at Deuteronomy 29, 10 to 29.
Deuteronomy 29, 10. You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders, and your officers with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day. For ye know how we have dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the nations which ye passed by. And ye have seen their abominations, and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them. Lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe, whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God, to go and serve the gods of these nations, lest there be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of my heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. The Lord will not spare him, but then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy shall smoke against that man, and all the curses that are written in this book shall lie upon him, and the Lord shall blot out his name from under heaven. And the Lord shall separate him unto evil out of all the tribes of Israel, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of the law, so that the generation to come of your children that shall rise up after you, and the stranger that shall come from a far land, shall say when they see the plagues of that land and the sicknesses which the Lord hath laid upon it, and that the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown nor beareth nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. Even all nations shall say, wherefore hath the Lord done thus unto this land? And what meaneth the heat of this great anger? Then men shall say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord, of their Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. For they went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they knew not, and whom he had not given unto them. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land, to bring upon it all the curses that are written in this book. And the Lord rooted them out of their land in anger, and in wrath, and in great indignation, and cast them into another land as it is this day. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law.
How do we know? Well, a lot of what we see going on there and a lot of this accommodation of the covenant is based upon the historical reality, the historical circumstance. They need to understand their history. They need to understand what they've come through, what they need to resist, what they need to pursue. They need to put all of this in terms of these covenant principles. They need to align themselves principially, even if the circumstances are changing. You know, changing circumstances does not mean changing morality, nor does it mean changing obligations. When you're in covenant, the obligation remains. The circumstance is going to change. Changes throughout your life. You know, when people are married, they're in covenant. That obligation changes from what it was when you were young to what it is when you're old. But there's an obligation. There's a constant. And it's like that when the church is in this covenant with God. The church is married to God. There's this covenant. The church has entered into this covenant, and there's an obligation going on. When the condition of the nation, the condition of the church, when they change, those are circumstantials. They're not substantial. They're not the matter. They're simply the form. So when covenants are renewed, it's very proper. It's right. In fact, it's necessary at times to make these kinds of circumstantial emendations. Now, I think what they did was very important. They did it in the margins, as they told us. And they did that so that we could see that they're not changing any principle. They didn't go through and just start striking out words. And they put a bracket around what they wanted to modify, and they put the modification in a margin. So you can see what was originally there. You could ask yourself, did they change a principle? Or were they simply adjusting the circumstance and acknowledging that the obligation was, in fact, an obligation that remained even though there's a change of circumstance? You know, with the vicissitudes of life in the course of a marriage, things change. People are born, people die. Socially, economically, there are ups and there are downs. You know, all those things about for better and for worse and all of that. Those are circumstances, but there's a constant. From time to time, there has to be an adjustment made to the circumstance. You've got to live with the circumstance. You have to roll with that if you're going to remain in covenant. And that's what they're saying that they're doing here. And they're pointing up. They pointed up that, you know, there's a change from Horeb to Moab. They'd spend some time in a wilderness. They learned some things. They had a different perspective on things. It wasn't everything that they thought going in. Things change. Their obligation, the underlying obligation, that doesn't change. So the final question we want to address now is, what are the, question five, what are the motives to renew the covenant? Well, the motives are many, but they give really five or six that I think are outlined pretty well. First, they point to a consideration of the wisdom, faithfulness, power, justice, and goodness of the Lord in granting them deliverance from Egypt. Now look at Deuteronomy 29:2 again.
Deuteronomy 29, verse 2. And Moses called unto all Israel and said unto them, ye have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt unto Pharaoh and unto all his servants and unto all his land.
When we think about the wisdom, the faithfulness, the power, the justice, the goodness of the Lord in granting him deliverance, we have a pretty good sense that now they see something more clearly, perhaps, than they were able to see going into it all. You know, what was not in the fore now is. What was not there initially, they now see clearly. Right. Second, there's a consideration of the great temptations wherewith he proved their faith, patience, humility, and love. The signs of his presence, protection, and power continued, and the miracles wrought on their behalf. Deuteronomy 29, verse 3.
The great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs, and those great miracles.
These are all circumstances, but they're motives as well. Right? They see the faithfulness of God. They see the greatness of temptation. Third, they have a consideration of their own hardness and stupidity, which didn't answer to the miracles and mercies aforementioned. Deuteronomy 29, verse 4.
Yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day.
God's faithful, wise, just. There are tremendous temptations around us. Oh, we're hard-hearted, we're stupid. Fourth, there's a consideration of the Lord's gracious conduct of them in the wilderness for 40 years, providing for their necessities. Deuteronomy 29:5-6.
Deuteronomy 29:5-6. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you, and thy shoe is not waxen old upon thy foot. You have not eaten bread, neither have you drunk wine or strong drink, that ye might know that I am the Lord your God.
God provided all the necessities. They now had 40 years to reflect upon that. Why do you want to still be the people of this God? Well, look what he did. For 40 years, he took care of all of this. You know, we're hard-hearted, we're stupid, but he still took care of all of this. He's displayed wisdom and faithfulness. We're faced with great temptations. We're stupid. Consider all of that. That's all why we should renew covenant. All right, fifth, the consideration of the glorious victory obtained in Moab against the heathen kings. Deuteronomy 29:7-8.
Deuteronomy 29:7-8. And when ye came unto this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out against us to battle, and we smote them. And we took their land and gave it for an inheritance unto the Reubenites, and to the Gadites, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh.
And finally, sixth, the promise of prosperity to ensue upon the keeping and doing of the covenant. Deuteronomy 29:9.
Deuteronomy 29:9. Keep therefore the words of this covenant, and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do.
God has, in fact, promised prosperity. This goes back to that very first thing that they talk about. God has, in fact, led us forth in a way that we don't know. He's given us a promise and allowed us to enter into this covenant. He's given us the place and the space to be entertained in this covenant. You know, he could simply demand. The promise of prosperity, the promises of God are annexed to the covenant. Because when we've only done what we're required to do, we're still unprofitable servants. There's no reward. There's no merit. We're not going to earn anything. If we're going to get anything from God, it's going to be by way of promise. It's not going to be by way of merit. You know, we're not going to find our way into God's good grace by doing something. The covenants, the motives to covenant, to renew covenant, are motives that take into account then, in fact, our circumstances. And that's, again, why should we be looking at giving an appropriate alteration to our circumstances? Well, you know, when we say, when we have to strike out the king's majesty and put lawful supreme magistrate, we're acknowledging a change of circumstance, which is not what we would describe as felicitous. It's not a good one. And that should be another motive for us to renew covenant. We should want to renew covenant with God. We don't want to keep this national and ecclesiastical backsliding going on. It has to stop somewhere, and somebody has to have the courage to move up and own the obligation. Until that happens, everything is in retrograde. So these are all the motives, really, in the beginning of Deuteronomy 29, the motives that are they're putting forth, the reasons why they're going to renew covenant. And these are all legitimate reasons for us as well. So they're important that we understand them, understand what they are and why they are. And if we think about our situation, we think about the justice and the goodness of God, his faithfulness, or the great temptations we're faced with in this present day, or consider our own hardness and stupidity. You know, we can go down this list and we can fill in the blanks with them. We can see principally that, or substantially, I should say, that things haven't really changed that much. You know, their diet might have been a little different. They had fewer modern conveniences than we have. But the alienation from God, the state of spiritual hostility in which they found themselves, wherever they ended up rubbing shoulders with other people, that was as real to them as it is to us. You know, substantially, we're not that far from them. Substantially, we share a lot if we strip away the circumstance and consider. And that's what they're inviting us to do. As we think about motives to renew covenant, if we start meditating on Deuteronomy 29, we can begin to see there are a lot of good reasons why. And that's why they're doing it in 1712. They see that. They're meditating on it. They are appropriating the substance, and they're making alteration to the circumstance in their minds and in the text of the covenant themselves, itself. They're making that kind of transition. They're moving the covenants from the 1640s to 1712. All right, next time we'll take this up again where we left off.